When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hello everyone and welcome to this week's episode of the Proper Class Podcast. I'm Hannah Chiswick.
And I'm Laura Checkley.
And we are of course here to celebrate all things working class. Just say it, get it over and done with.
Because if we don't, who the bloody hell will order? That's just a little clue as to who might be in this week with us, Hannah. Did you enjoy that?
No, no one enjoyed that. Absolutely no one enjoyed it.
Carry on. As always, we sit down with a working class hero to celebrate their life and achievements and discuss just how they got to where they are today. And on that note, who are we celebrating this week, Han?
Well, I have to tell you, I hardly slept last night because I'm honestly so excited about this week's guest. When Laura and I first spoke about doing this podcast, we both agreed that this incredible woman was right up the top of our wish list.
That's right. I can't actually believe she's agreed to sit down and chat with us pair of idiots, to be perfectly honest, but there we go.
Speak for yourself. This week's guest is a politician, author and podcaster, and it really won't take long into this introduction for you to guess who we're talking about, because this woman is still very much in a minority of female voices in her field.
Describing herself as quite rowdy in the chamber, this week's guest constantly pushes female issues to the fore and is the ultimate champion for gender equality, stating that she views one of the main priorities of her post to be making the topic of violence against women and girls a mainstream issue. This year for International Women's Day, she unforgettably read out the name of every woman killed at the hands of domestic abusers in the last year, a chilling and moving 5 minutes that brought the entire house to a silence.
Braving professional and personal abuse, this woman is never shy to challenge the latent misogyny she and other female politicians describe as being rife in Westminster. In a recent Guardian interview, she said, "The culture in Westminster is not an overtly sexist one. The culture in Westminster is one where people protect their own, but their own being men. Men are more likely to be protected by other men than women are to be protected."
In a world where representation is so essential, this week's guest really feels like our girl at the coalface. And it is endlessly reassuring to see her standing up and daring to be herself, something that often seems like a political act in itself. She explains you get men, and it's always men on the opposite benches who treat you like a harridan for behaving exactly as they behave.
When we were chatting yesterday, Laura described her as the Kathy Burke of politics. And if you know me and Laura, there really is no bigger compliment we could give. It is an honour and, all honesty, a bit of a pinch me moment to welcome this week's guest, the MP for Birmingham Yardley and Shadow Minister for Domestic Violence and Safeguarding, the endlessly inspiring Jess Phillips.
Hey!
Thanks, it's very nice of you to say all those really nice things about me. I feel bowled over.
Do you?
Yeah. I love Kathy Burke.
I'm so glad you took that as a compliment because, you know, I mean, she's a goddess, right? I mean, she is for us anyway. So,
but people throw it at me as an insult all the time. And I just think, you're right. I am like Kathy Burke.
Yeah, thank
I'd
you
love
very
to
much.
Be like Kathy Burke. Yeah.
In the unlikely you. Event anyone ever wanted to make a movie about me, that would never happen. I'd love Kathy Burke to play me. That would literally be goals right there. I think she's like the queen of most things.
She is the queen, the absolute queen. Is this going to be in vision when you put it on?
No, absolutely not. No.
Our vapes were out then. You can say that. I don't mind it being known. I just don't necessarily want people to watch me. What can only be described. I literally just lectured some 19-year-olds when I was buying these children's vapes. I said, you're not old enough to be buying these vapes. And they were like, oh, we are old enough, as if I was IDing them. And then I was just like, no, I just mean, why the fuck are you starting to smoke at your age?
Kids aren't even bothering to get ciggies first, are they? They're just going straight to vapes. It's madness.
A 19-year-old young woman in my local corner shop. I'm in Walthamstow at the moment. It's where I live when I'm in London. And she was like, well, life's very hard. And I was just like, why is your life hard? Like, your life isn't hard. And then I was like, also, smoking doesn't make your life less hard, you div. It makes it harder.
I know. Yes.
And then I proceeded to buy a Vimto-flavoured children's vape, so I've got no leg to stand on.
Vimto-flavoured.
Marched out the shop with a Vimto-flavoured... and that told them kids. So, Jess, we start each week asking our guests to take us back to somewhere that connects them to their working class roots. Where would that be for you today? If you could take us anywhere, where would that be?
If I could take you anywhere, I would take you to Garrett's Green Lane, which happens to be in my constituency, and it would be to my grandma, Peggy, who doesn't get as many mentions, but it would be to my grandma Peggy's house. So in 1981, when I was born, inflation was wild. And interest rates had gone up to, like, I don't know, like 15%. Lovely. And so it's a bit like now.
A little bit like, I'd say.
Yeah. It's, you know, we're basically living in 1981. And my mum, who had not worked, like, I've got three older brothers and she'd not worked. But they had bought this bigger house in South Birmingham. And then the interest rates rocketed. And so my mum was like, look, we can't afford it. If I can't afford to stay at home and look after the kids. So basically, I was shipped off to my granny Peggy, my grandma Peggy's house. Her name was Marguerite.
Oh, wow.
But everyone called her
Swanky.
Peggy.
Yeah, those names, when they shorten, it makes no sense. Always
makes
blow my
no
mind.
Sense. Marguerite? I mean, that's so fancy. I don't know what business my grandma Peggy had been called Marguerite. She was not a Marguerite at all. I basically was shipped off to their council house on Garrett's Green Lane in my constituency to be cared for pretty much all day, every day, while my mum went out to work. Yes, and that is literally in my head, if I close my eyes and think about sort of working class environments, my grandma Peggy's house, it was like a sort of, you know, your standard two up, two down, 1930s council house on an estate.
Yeah.
And she lived there with my granddad Eric and my nanny Mabel, who was actually called Rose.
Oh, stop.
I don't know what. Working class people do that a lot.
But not.
Posh people do that a lot, don't they? Working class Irish people are all called Mary and so go by a different name, in my experience.
Yeah. So true.
So my middle name is Rose after my nanny Mabel Rose. Yeah. But her name was Rose West. And she was married to a man called Fred West. So maybe she had foresight and that's why she went by Mabel.
Wow. Oh, my God. Yeah, right. That's pretty
stick to Mabel there, Rose.
Yeah,
stick
not the
Mabel.
Same. Not the same people, I must stress. But she lived there. She was born in like 1889, my nanny Mabel.
Wow.
Yeah, so she was old. And so she was in like her 90s. And she had a sort of bed set up in the house, like downstairs. A bit like Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, essentially. A bit like Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. And she taught me to gamble.
Nice.
And she'd say, give us a kiss and I'll lend you, and lend me sixpence. In a sort of like, I've gambled so much that I need you to give me sixpence. her and my granny Peggy, they were fierce women. And my auntie Mary, whose name was actually Mary and went by Mary, contrary to what I just said.
Wow.
My Auntie Mary, who was my grandma Peggy's sister, she didn't live there. I think she did live there at this point. So it was this house of very, very working class matriarchal women. And my granddad Eric, who was just a really nice man and just sort of kept quiet. But I mean, this to me is the absolute pinnacle of the culture of working class households, is that my granny Peggy had a deep freezer in her living room that she would throw over she would like throw over a thing like an antimacassar, like a tablecloth to like pretend that there wasn't a deep freezer in it.
Love
but she
that.
Had a deep freezer in her living room, and it was like the stuff of gold. It was like El Dorado when you opened it, like, because she used to make cakes. Like her job, I mean, she worked on the buses and she worked in munitions factories and stuff during the war, but in later life, in retirement, she was brilliant at decorating cakes. So she would make people's wedding cakes and things, and so she'd sit with one of those wheels like piping cakes and things and made us amazing birthday cakes and things. But she would make cream horns. You don't see a cream horn anymore.
Rarely
see a cream horn.
Yeah.
But she would make hundreds of cream horns.
I'm so sorry, what is a cream horn again? I know it, but is
it's like an ice cream cone that's made out of essentially the pastry of an apple turnover, filled with cream and a bit of jam.
Right, okay,
A cornet.
Like an ice cream cone.
I'll get you one after.
Yeah, please do.
I don't think they exist anymore. I think the cream horn has gone with focaccia and wild garlic has taken over.
Do you remember those things that you get from the ice cream van? Was it an oyster? It was like an oyster.
Yeah, oyster.
I had one on Sunday. Do you remember a Popeye? This is when I was a kid,
Screwball.
When you talk about things that you think of as really affluent, we talk about this on the podcast. Go, like when I was younger, I thought as a little kid, the most like to get a Popeye. So basically, it was an ice cream with an ice lolly stuck in the top of a Mr. Whippy.
Oh my God.
And my mum was like, no, absolutely not. It's like an extra 20p or whatever. And I thought, that right there is.
I've only ever seen that once. But you're absolutely right that these things are. And not the way they used to be. And a 99 now costs £2. I mean
change the name, at least.
Change
the name. False advertising or what?
But she had these cream horns and she would make hundreds of them and we would go to the freezer. She also insisted, as if it was doing us a kindness, to put sugar in our tea. She used to say to me, don't worry, I won't tell your dad. And I used to think, please do tell him so he can intervene. Like,
I don't want this sugar.
I don't want sugar in my tea. It tastes disgusting. She smoked fags like there was like no tomorrow. Like all of them.
That brimming ashtray.
How my nanny Mabel survived until her 90s. My grandma didn't. She died in her 60s, as did my granddad died in his 60s. How she, my nanny Mabel, had survived in that household, I have no idea, but she did.
Lungs of steel, by the sound of it.
Yeah, absolutely must have had lungs of steel. But they smoked all the time. And also, we always had to show a kindness to random cousins. She would also look after, your second, third cousin, like cousin Danielle, who was grumpy. And she was like, you've got to be nice to her. She doesn't have a nice house like you.
My nan's house is always full of my cousins and us. We just stayed there all the time. When I was staying at my nan's a lot, my great nan was there as well. But all my nans are called Wynne. So my mum's mum was called Wynne.
I didn't know
My nan's mum was called Wynne. My dad's mum was called Winifred. And then my stepdad's mum was called Winifred.
Jesus. Well, we had an Auntie Wynne.
So many Winifreds.
My nanny Peggy, her Auntie Joyce, who was married to her brother, so was her sister-in-law. This is how loose this is that, so Auntie Joyce wasn't really related to us through anything but marriage and then having children who became cousins to my dad.
Yeah.
Her sister was called Wynne, but she was Auntie Wynne. But, I mean, this is a working class thing, is you must call everybody auntie and uncle, even if they lent your dad their ladders in 1972.
Yeah,
like almost. Uncle Chris, who lives over the road from my mum and dad, not my uncle at all, no relation whatsoever, but he's Uncle Chris. Auntie Pat, Auntie Sue, Uncle Mick, these people. And I would never be able to say their names. Sometimes now that I'm a Member of Parliament, they email me and they don't sign it off like Auntie Sue. And I'm like that, oh God, I don't know who that's from.
So you lived with your nan for quite a long time, did you?
I would go home in the evenings at like 7 o'clock. But from the age of naught till I was about five. And she died when I was seven.
Mm.
And my granddad died when I was about four. She moved, actually. She I'm afraid to say this. My granny was a massive Thatcherite. She bought that council house and immediately sold it, like almost everybody does when they buy a council house.
And
she moved to closer to where we lived and then died almost immediately.
It's interesting you talk about your nan being a Thatcherite, like, because I've got a lot of working class family that have voted Conservative for years from that sort of Thatcherite kind of era. What was it about that time that, do you think, working class people, I mean, how, I don't understand as a working class person myself how you connect with a Conservative. I just don't.
It's funny,
you know?
Because my nan lived around the corner, so I'm Garrett's great, but they're both, these houses are in my constituency. My nan lived in what she would have called Yardley proper, and if you'd said anything else she would have been pissed off,
right?
In a bought house. My dad, the amount of ribbing that my dad would give my mum about being from a bought house was untrue.
Right.
Oh, well, she would say that she's from a bought house. I mean, they bought it for like £12 in 1930.
Yeah, but never mind, yeah.
£12, we couldn't have imagined it.
I know,
my
dad
would say. But she lived literally like round the corner from Garrett's Green Lane where my granny lived. And my nan and granddad on my mum's side were total socialists. They were die-in-the-wool union activists. And my granddad, Eric, funnily enough, he was a Labour, he was a Labour supporting man, again, from the union movement. But my granny, and I asked my dad is such like a devout socialist, and my Uncle Graham, his brother, similarly is a devout socialist. And they're like, how did you end up being devout socialist growing up in this house of, you know, like sort of neo-Thatcherism?
Yeah.
And what I would say is that they lived their lives like socialists, as most working class people do.
Yep.
Whether their politics is socialist or not, they're so my nan was like, you know, she was the head of all the committees on the council estate, like tenants associations and things. She was always trying to improve. She'd have given her last bean to anyone, even black people who she was undoubtedly not that kind about in her language, as many working class people of that era were not. Whereas my nanny, who lived round the corner in the bought house, it's exactly the same house. In fact, my grandma's house was bigger, but nonetheless.
nonetheless, it was hers.
My nan, like, chained herself to, like, the railings when the South African team wouldn't let black people play. So, you know, they're very, very different people.
Yeah.
But my grandma Peggy, my dad always says when I ask him, he says that it was to do with empire. Is what
right.
he thinks.
Right.
So basically, there were these three women left who raised me when I was very little, and they were left because everybody had died, and everybody had died in either the First or the Second World War. And my great grandfather, my two of my uncles, you know, in the sort of Gallipoli landings, and you know, there was both First and Second World War deaths, and it just basically left this shell where only the women were left. And for me, that was very formative because I just thought everybody's family is run by essentially a group of harridan women.
Kick-ass women,
But for them, I think it was this sort of commitment to God, the Queen and the country that Mrs. Thatcher tapped into so successfully. And also the idea of buying their council house definitely
appealed
to my nan.
Yeah, you can do better. Yeah, you can better yourself.
Whereas my nan already had a bought house. She was so fancy. I mean, so fancy that she was put in service. She was literally enslaved, my nan, and put in service to a rich, posh aunt because her dad didn't want her after her mum had died. So it's not like she had, like, the greatest life ever. I was raised by these women who'd been through a huge amount of collective and individual trauma.
Yeah. And did you grow up in, like, a very political household yourself?
Yes.
Like, were your parents very political?
Yes, very. And when my grandma come round, my dad would just argue with her constantly about it.
Yeah.
I mean, very, 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 very political. We were, you know, I was raised on a picket line, basically, or with a CND thing tattooed on my face. You can probably still see it from the years of... I mean, we used to do, like, balloon releases for the environment. How naive we were.
Wow. I mean, the irony there...
We'd release a balloon for anything back then.
How was school for you, Jess?
I went to my local primary school, and that was in what now, hilariously, the area I went to primary school in. and the primary school I went to is now the kind of primary school that people move in order to get their children into.
Yeah, yeah.
But it basically has a feeder of three large council estates that are no longer council estates, but are full of people who can't afford to live in their Victorian houses in that bit of Birmingham. And so it's very, very middle class now, funnily enough. But when I went there, it was the feeder of 1980s, sink estates, essentially. A place called Allen's Croft, Waldron's Moor, where I grew up. And so at primary school, I was genuinely one of the poshest kids. Like by quite a considerable amount. My dad was a teacher, and even though, you know, my family are thoroughly working class, we lived in this house that then my mum had to go back and work to try and afford. But I really loved primary school. I absolutely loved it, but it would be unrecognisable now, the school that I went to, unrecognisable for the sort of kids that go there.
And I take it you were academic.
I was always really clever, and I had a teacher, funnily enough, called Mrs. Furman, who... I'm best friends with her daughter, so I still see her.
Oh, how nice.
And when she was my teacher in reception, and she just spotted me as being sort of bright, sparky and clever. And she was a member of the Labour Party, and I used to rant about politics at the age of four.
Wow.
And she really, really, really pushed me. Like, she made me, like, she was like, you're a clever kid. You should, you know, do whatever you can to make it in the world. And then I went to the grammar school.
Yeah.
So
what, you like took your 11 pluses and got into grammar school?
I took my 11 plus. In Birmingham, we have a system of free grammar schools. You don't pay for them. And my parents were dead against me going, but I was really competitive and still am, and really wanted to take my test. And then I got in. So I went to the grammar school. But I have to say, even that's changed now. Even that, when I went to the grammar school that I went to, whilst lots of kids were from the posher bits of Birmingham, it was still much more mixed. And now it's not, it's just people who've been, I mean, I think they've just in the last couple of years made a real effort to get more pupil premium kids in. But for a spell, it got to be just kids who like could afford all the tutoring.
Yeah, absolutely.
I never had any tutoring. I remember we went on holiday, like the week before my exam, and my mum gave me a book she bought in WH Smith and said, "Oh, this is what your exam will be." That was my level of tutoring.
It's hard, isn't it? Because I know my brother was severely dyslexic. He's older than me, and we went to a really run-down school in Hounslow. It's still pretty run-down, bless it. And my mum used to try really hard. She used to do, like, extra spelling tests, and she'd try, but my mum wasn't hugely academic. Like, she's a bright woman, but she's not been... I mean, she left school at 14.
Yeah, my parents did.
But she tried really hard. But, you know, what else can parents do if they can't afford that? Like, and if you're at a school where, you know, you get left behind if you're not very good at something,
really,
like, what
really
chance
noticed
do
we... that, you know, I've got a six-year-old, and I really, really noticed that. Like, so I went to like a terrible school and a big housing estate in South London. But in lockdown, I really noticed with my son, like, even within state schools, there's such a massive difference between schools. So, like, we went into lockdown and his school tried really, really hard, but they were doing appeals for, like, is there any chance anyone's got an old laptop that we could give to a family? Blah, blah, blah. And my mate's kids were going, oh, yes, you know, they've got their 2 hours of Mandarin online.
Oh, no.
And I was like, they're at a state school as well. Like, it's not just state to
There is a vast
like
difference.
The vast difference. And
a
somehow
vast,
it was
vast
so...
difference. And my kids both go to, I mean, one of them's left now, and so he's at college, but they both go to the local comprehensive. And it pulls from a very middle-class area, the bit that I now live in, and one of the poorest areas in the country are the two sort of areas that of kids that go to this school. And the difference you can see in... I remember doing a thing with a Tory MP about, like, fundraising for school, and they were like, well, we go out to the parent community. And I just thought, yeah, in Yardley, all you're going to get is requests.
Yeah.
Like, the idea that people have got cash to spare to help the school buy books and things, like... I mean, and I do appeals to posh people to buy books for schools in my constituency. Funnily enough, the husband of the woman who wrote 50 Shades of Grey gave me money to put books in the school.
Not
50 Shades
that
of Grey.
Did you say you go, children? Off you go. Reading is reading.
Reading. My father's an English teacher. He would say reading is worthwhile.
So you're at this grammar school, and did you already have like aspirations to be? Did you know you were going to be a politician?
When I look back, I mean, I was quite wild at school, as I just lectured the young women in the newsagents about smoking. I started smoking when I was 11 years old. I was quite naughty. I wasn't naughty at school, like, because I was clever, essentially. If you go to a grammar school like the one I went to, if you're clever, you can get away with murder. If you're going to get the results, they don't care.
Don't care. Yeah.
I was quite wild at school, but I was very political. And recently, somebody had put on Facebook, like, a thing from a yearbook. I don't even remember that we had a yearbook. It was definitely organised by people who were considerably less naughty than me. And it gave, like, all our jobs for the future. It's deeply unfeminist. Like, I saw my mate Mairead, and she was like, mine just said, I would marry.
With the fingers crossed said,
marry
emoji.
A rugby player. Yeah, it's just like, dudes, like, we're like the top 1% of intelligent women in the city.
Oh my God.
Marrying a rugby player seemed to be the aspiration, but mine said that I would be the prime minister.
I hope that's right. I'd like that to still come true, Jess.
So
if you wouldn't mind.
If there's any
I'm
hope
gonna put
left
a deep
in the
freeze
world.
Full of cream horns in number 10.
Yeah, listen, there are worse things. Give them out. So you go to uni and was that a good experience? Did you enjoy it?
No, I didn't enjoy university at all. And actually, I put this down to, even though I went to a grammar school, and like I say, it was much more mixed. I mean, there was lots of middle-class people there, but much more mixed. That when I went to university, it was the first time I ever encountered actual posh people.
Yeah.
It was a shock to me. I remember the woman I lived with, lovely woman called Emily, who'd gone to a private school in London. I remember her nan, I lived with her, she was lovely, but her nan used to send us like clippings from the Daily Mail. So we always talked about her nan. And at one point her nan had gone like on a sort of like Buddhist holiday to Bali or Goa or somewhere.
Lovely.
And I was like, I have no concept of a person whose nan goes anywhere other than on a charabang holiday to Western.
Yeah.
Like that Caravan is as far holiday, as my nan it. Ever yeah. went. And she only ever went on a coach.
My nan never went out of the country.
She never. Not.
No,
my
she
nan went once.
Weren't bothered about it either.
Once. Nah,
yeah. My nan never left the country. My grandma did, actually. Funnily enough, my grandma Peggy did. She went and visited lots of the sites where her brothers and her dad and were buried because they'd been killed in the war.
Yeah, I think a lot of people did that, didn't they?
Yeah. Yeah, so she did that. But she went on a coach.
Oh, wow.
You know, she went on a coach. I understood the concept of the baby boomer generation because my parents were essentially that. They were well-educated people who were born into very working-class environments but had been given literally the very best of everything the welfare state had to offer post-1945 and had therefore been able to provide much more for their own kids. Not much more, actually. Much more isn't fair on my grandparents. Just a different culture, an opportunity for a different culture. But the idea that someone has a rich nan is like, I'd never met a person with a rich nan.
No.
Also, in my first year, I lived in halls with a woman who went to Cheltenham Ladies College, right? Again, lovely woman, no criticism of her. She went to Cheltenham Ladies College and she had never seen a doner kebab.
Oh, get out. Stop.
Do you know what? I lived with this rich woman. She won't mind me saying. She's always come from money. And I took some Dairy Lee Dunkers round hers once. And she'd never seen a Dairy Lee Dunker. She was amazing. And she was like, Laura, what is this? Like, it was just such an... I was really proud that I introduced her to some Dairy Lee Dunkers.
And I love a Dairy Lee Dunker. But she was, we're outside the station chit shop. She was like, oh my God, what is that? And I was, genuinely did not know what she was talking about. I was like, what? And she was like, what is that? And I was like, it's a doner kebab. Like,
oh,
what?
Actually, Jess, let me tell you this story quickly. We've got a mutual friend. She's quite posh, isn't she? She's not middle class. She don't mind. No, oh, bless her. She's always getting a bashing on here, isn't she? But she once saw some chips and with some mushy peas on top. And she said to her boyfriend at the time, oh, look, Phil, they do chips and avocado.
We're talking
back in like early 2000s, though, when I didn't even know what an avocado was, I'll be honest. I'd never had an avocado.
There is an apocryphal story about Peter Mandelson in the Labour Party. It's not true, but it's I like it so much, where he thought it was guacamole.
Yeah, let's say it's true, because it's funny.
Yeah, let's say it's true. Who cares? It's definitely not true, but he agrees that it's a great enough story that we should just say it's true forever. But yeah, I'd never met anybody. And so it's a good, it was a good learning curve for Westminster.
Right.
Because I'd never met anybody who was posh.
It's so amazing, uni, for that, isn't it? Because like, I went to uni and I was like, what on earth? Like, people going, I remember going to a mate's house and he had a lake in the middle of his house. I was like, this is how some people live with a lake.
Yeah.
Like, it was like, oh, that's our lake.
I just thought he had a lovely driveway, you were similar posh, thing, you know right? I mean?
Lovely fella. And he said to me, he goes, do you fancy coming skiing at Easter? And I was like, love. Like, I'm going back to London to get a job front of house in a theatre. Like, I can't be going skiing. And I was like, where have you got the money for that? And he goes, oh, you know, it's funny, isn't it, life? You sort of struggle to find the odd bits and bobs, but there's always money for skiing. And I was like, no. There isn't, mate, no.
I have the exact opposite saying. What, like, if I wanted to go skiing, I wouldn't be able to find the money. But when the boiler's fucking broken.
Yeah, sure.
I'm like, how did I just have this £3,000 that I can now spend waste on a bloody boiler?
Fucking boiler. It,
with the working class, it's only ever really you find your money for your fags if you smoke.
Yeah.
You always find your money for your fags, no
that
matter
what.
That
is absolutely true. Petrol money from down the side of the sofa just to get the car going.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I'd never met. And there was a lad in my history class, and actually I started studying politics, but I hated it because it was full of, basically I just was expecting everybody to be socialist radicals, and it was full of conservatives talking about John Maynard Keynes and John Stuart Mill, basically white old men called John. Yeah. And so I did social policy for a bit as an elective credit, and that had some people from the prison in the class, like that, from Armley Prison in Leeds, and this single mom who was a mature student, and we talked about benefits, and I was like, okay, I'm going to move to social policy, this is much better. But there was a lad in my politics class who, because I'm the same age as Prince William, who had been in Prince William's class at Eton, and his family, he never went home at the in the holidays because his family lived in Hong Kong.
Yeah.
I was like that.
Yeah, very similar. Very similar.
We've got the same upbringing, basically.
Well, Peggy's been away, you know, you never know. Yeah. She could have been in Hong Kong.
That's it. She's been to Gallipoli.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com. Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This is quite a big leap, but you mentioned before about obviously like being in Westminster. Every time we ask our guests about like imposter syndrome. Now, my God, if there's anywhere in the world as a working class person, you must be open to the idea of imposter syndrome. I mean, how was that when you first went into Parliament? Or had by then you sort of thought, no, I deserve to be here and this is my time?
Yeah, no, I think that to be perfectly honest, the reason I sort of decided to take the leap was I was working at Women's Aid and we ran a female offenders service. When the government were privatising all female offender services. And I went to this briefing event about how they were going to sell off the package areas. It was at Birmingham Botanical Gardens.
Very nice.
I went to this briefing event and the then Justice Secretary spoke and he was so shit and he knew so little about what he was talking about. I thought, look, if he can be a Member of Parliament, I can... you know, be the queen of the world.
Yeah.
And so I have remained very, very forthright. And this is still the case that on the things that I know about, I know more about it than anyone in the building. And so I very rarely on the subjects that I know and care about feel imposter syndrome. But when I first went there, I was totally bowled over by the building, obviously, and the grandeur of it. Not that it's really, it's not posh actually, it's literally falling apart and it's full of mice. I've definitely worked in better offices, but like the history of it is overwhelming.
Mm.
And that history is very posh and very male in lots of circumstances. But I just felt defiant about that. I still feel imposter syndrome about things that definitely people like me don't go out and talk about. And that's things like, you know, sort of high level foreign affairs is the pursuit of people whose dads live in Hong Kong in the diplomatic service
and
things like that. Yeah. I didn't know what the diplomatic service was before I was elected. Do you know what I mean? Like, I just thought, like, one of my mates once got banged up in jail in Ibiza and we went to the consular. He was freed.
I mean, that's foreign affairs, right?
That was my interaction with
abroad.
That was my interaction with, you know, our man abroad.
Yeah, yeah.
Was that, you know, occasionally I'd known people getting criminal trouble in a different country.
Brilliant.
But, you know, so I do still feel, but I just, even when I feel it, I sort of take power from the people who are actually affected by it. So the sort of Afghanistan crisis, my constituency is full of Afghan families. And so I take their being the person who knows more about it than anyone in the building. I sort of take that and wear it as a badge when I'm having to do those things. I definitely feel imposter syndrome. But the posher the people are that I come across, the wilder I grow. It's I am like a dangerous, like I misbehave appallingly. Like I will grow into like an animal of being like, you're not better than me. And that comes from, it's not even particularly a chip on my shoulder. I wouldn't even describe it as that. But because I've got three older brothers, my parents drilled into me every single day of my life. There's nothing they can do that you can't do. And it turned me into a bit of a monster. But that definitely has helped me not feel particular class boundaries.
And we talk about this a lot about how we speak, like Hannah's a theatre director and she's been judged for, you know, having a South London accent and wearing a hoop every day by, you know, rich white men on a theatre board or whatever.
Yeah.
How did you find it? Because obviously you've got a really prominent accent, a working class one, which, you know, that was one of the first reasons when I heard you speak for the first time, I'd become so like engaged with you and engaged in what you were speaking about and politics in itself. Have you had assumptions yourself? I'm sure you have. I think I've read bits about how...
Yeah, I get assumptions that I'm stupid because...
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, actually, funnily enough, one of the biggest assumptions people make, because I have a regional accent, is that I am, like, very, very, very working class.
Yeah.
In actual fact,
yeah.
And this is a very, very southeast thing, is that if you have an accent in the southeast, you are working class. That's
yeah,
just the case.
I agree,
because,
yeah.
You know, the, it's a sort of non... You either have that generic posh accent or you speak estuary English. Those are the two options
yeah.
in the southeast. Whereas in Newcastle, middle-class people speak with a Geordie accent.
Yeah.
And in Birmingham, middle-class people speak with a Birmingham accent.
Yeah.
Like, you know, but because everything is so southeast-centric, lots of assumptions are made about you. But yeah, people assume I'm stupid. People assume I've spelt things wrong. So the one that pisses me off the most, because it is my actual name, according to the two most important people to me in the world, is that I say mom and I spell it M-O-M. And that's what everybody in Birmingham does. And people like, mummy is terribly posh to us. Like, oh, the idea of being called mum.
Oh, no, my mum said, don't ever call me mum. I've never said mummy, no. It feels
yeah,
weird
exactly.
for me, I know.
But people assume I've spelt it wrong because I'm stupid. I'm like, no, I'm just from fucking Birmingham.
Yeah.
It's actually, yeah, my mate's from Birmingham. She's like, she said she always gets corrected when she writes.
It's very annoying.
As if you're going to, like, by your age and all the things you've achieved, not know how to
is
spell
it. Is this my name? This is my name. I know how to spell it. I am mom. Like, that is what my sons call me. I know how to spell it, you idiot.
It's actually two letters. One repeated.
And actually, that wouldn't happen to people from Newcastle who say ma'am. Like, that is accepted. Whereas the fact that I say mom is not accepted. And I had to get, like, Hansard, the people who write up everything that we say in Parliament. I have to get them to correct it every time. And it's like, so annoying. But yeah, people make assumptions about me all the time. They make assumptions that that I'm stupid.
Another one we get is crass.
Oh, yeah.
Crass.
Oh, yeah.
I was in
a
comedy double act and we were quite old fashioned, actually, and a bit sort of French and Saunders like, very sort of harmless fun, wasn't it? And one of our reviews said we were like a couple of Cockney birds having a fight outside a kebab shop. And it was actually that's what we got all the time.
I get a lot of that. You also get like firebrand. Now, I am actually a bit of a firebrand, so that I don't mind so much. But the reality is that you only think that because you when I speak, what you hear is that I'm being caustic.
Yeah.
And black women get this all the time, like the idea that it's aggressive.
Yeah, yeah.
What they're saying.
Yeah.
Even though they just might be saying, pass me the milk. But the way it's heard is that they're sucking their teeth while asking somebody. Like, it's just like, it's a horrible thing. But yeah, that I'm aggressive, I get quite a lot just because I have a regional accent.
And you know what
and in some cases, I am a bit aggressive. And to be honest, because I come from very tough, willing to fight their corner, working class women and men, I imagine to polite society, I might come across as being a bit caustic, but why would you assume that that was the thing that was wrong?
Yeah.
Why is the default pretending that nothing bad has happened? The default of politeness is pretending nothing bad has happened.
Yeah.
And it's just like, well, that never solved anything, did it? Pretending that nothing's happened.
We often speak to our guests who've got kids about this. Like, are your kids have they had a very different upbringing to you?
Yes.
Yes,
they've had a completely and utterly different. I mean, I have incredibly working class roots and upbringing, but by comparison to my husband, I'm lady of the manor.
Right.
He was born in social housing. He similarly doesn't have, he didn't go to school really past, he did go to college past his A-levels, but he learnt to skin up better than he learnt to do anything else. And he has a manual job. He's a lift engineer and now does, like, I actually don't know really what he does.
Stuff.
Something to do with building stuff. my husband went on, like, one foreign holiday in his entire childhood. So, whereas my children, like, the sort of expectation that we will go away at least once a year, like on holiday. The biggest thing for me is when I was a kid, I remember like once a year we'd go and it felt like we were like driving all the way to Wolverhampton or somewhere, but it probably wasn't because you have no concept of car journeys when you're a kid. But we would go out for one dinner a year, like in a restaurant, and it had to be like for a major event.
Yeah.
And like you'd go to an Indian or a Chinese, those were the two options. But my kids eat out all the time. But the thing that really gets me is their expectation that we will stop at every service station on our journey and they will buy things.
So
I remember
true.
Once being outside, like, I don't know, Chiltern Services on the M40 being like, we're raising twats. They just, you know, like, I'm really worried that we're raising children with terrible privilege. Now, luckily, both my children, of their friends, they are undoubtedly the poshest without question.
Right.
They, like I say, they went to state school and all of their friends at school are, you know, my older son, like all of his friends at school pretty much were the Muslim kids from the other bit of where the school pulls from. And he definitely recognises that he is privileged and lucky.
Is that important for you to instil that in them? I mean, that's kind of, yeah.
100%.
I'd be really pleased that they've got those friends, you know?
Yeah,
I'd be
so pleased. Yeah. No, like, my older son actually came down to London for a bit to go to a film school here because we don't have that in Birmingham when he was 16. And he just said, like, it was a different world. It was a different, like, it was in Islington. And he was just like, because there's posh and then there's London posh, and those two things are different.
Yeah, oh, totally.
Like, being middle class in London and being middle class in Birmingham are as different as day and night. Like, you know, the sort of standard idea of going to a private school just doesn't exist in Birmingham, not at all. That's not a thing. Even middle class people don't send their kids to private school in Birmingham.
Wow, okay.
And middle class people in Birmingham are like teachers and social workers.
Yeah.
Whereas middle-class people in London are like high court judges or people who run television production companies. And,
right.
and so my son, definitely, he found it, like, he was like, wow, this is a different world. That was a bit like his university moment.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it's really important for me that they stay humble and grounded in the sort of culture that both me and their dad came from. Although I feel we failed.
And are they political?
They're political. I mean, my 17-year-old is political the way that all woke 17-year-olds are political.
Yeah, sure.
Oh, my God. Sometimes I'm just like, give it a rest. they campaign and stuff. They don't have quite, funnily enough, they don't have quite such a political upbringing as the one that I had.
Yeah.
But they're not fighting for anything, are they? Because I suppose they've got a seat at the table. Whereas we were in the 80s and the Thatcher government in working class households, we were fighting for something. So it was very political.
Mm.
But yeah, they are. But neither of them will ever end up being politicians. God, no, they'd rather be dead.
It's such an interesting thing you were saying there, because I went to uni up in Hull and I was like the first person in my family to go to uni. And like I said, I went to a big comp on a housing estate in South London. And then when I got up to uni, I worked doing a needle exchange, very glamorous, on a housing estate in Hull. And the difference between this housing estate in Hull and this housing estate that was considered very rough in South London, I thought I was quite worldly, that I had experienced. But this, the deprivation in that housing estate in Hull was, like, I'd never seen anything like that, and I wasn't growing up. I hadn't gone to eating.
You're not 1 minute away from, like, in London, every corner I turn, and I live since I've moved down to London to be in Westminster. First of all, I started living in Brixton, and now I live in Walthamstow. I essentially like to live at the extremities of the Victoria line.
I really want
a seat on the tube is essentially the reason why that is the case. But, like, even in the deprived areas, there is, like, a council playground. Like, that doesn't exist where I live. And if it does, it's got one broken swing and it's covered in needles. Like, you know, that the level of facilities that London has, and therefore opportunity for seeing the world in a different way to maybe the one that you see in the four walls of your house, is completely different to other parts of the country. Completely different.
But even in London, like, and I'm a theatre director, right? So there's not many more middle class things you could do. And I feel like an oddity in my industry all the time because I'm a woman and, you know, and because I didn't go to Eton. But yet I still feel, and I know there are those housing estates in Hull and Birmingham and that never in my lifetime have I felt that there is a government
that doesn't understand the way that we live or the average person lives so much as I feel now. And I grew up in a very political household too, but I have never felt
that's
that.
Absolutely right. Even I mean, it's like Trump made you miss George W. Bush.
Right. Yeah.
Thatcher wouldn't have dreamed of the things that this government thinks, actually.
Yeah.
She wouldn't have dreamed of it. And, you know, she was no saviour of estates in London or around the country, without question. But you're absolutely right. There's never been a time where and they've managed somehow to convince lots of the people who live in those sorts of places that it's somebody's fault other than
the
government's. And that is pernicious. That is really pernicious.
It feels really disheartening and without hope, I'll be honest, you know. It's like it just feels really hopeless at the moment.
Also, like things like the arts and stripping away education for the masses that would include arts, music, like, you know, that they're becoming much more even so than any other point in my life, middle class pursuits.
Yeah, for sure.
And the schools in my constituency work so hard to try and buck that trend. But the head teachers are leaving and things because they're just like, it's an assault on our communities. Like, it is just dreadful. So, yeah, that's absolutely the case. The idea that you can't be what you can't see. Mm. And in London, there is just more to see. So even if you're in a crappy situation, there's more jobs around you to see, not even just like at your access to be able to get a job, but you're more likely to come across people with a variation of employments and things and more access to arts, culture, that sort of thing just doesn't exist. And it takes a huge amount of investment in that sort of thing to change that. And that is just, there's none of that.
Yeah.
I mean, the security conversation about members of parliament comes up all the time. And somebody said to me, well, you should only hold, it was a London MP said to me, you should only hold your surgeries in council buildings. I said, there aren't any council buildings in my constituency.
Yeah,
they've all gone.
That lack of knowing that. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, you know, so in my constituency, which serves like 150,000 people, there is no neighbourhood office left anymore. There is no council building. There is nothing. There is me. That's it.
And it makes the fight feel impossible, doesn't it?
Yeah.
To match them, to get
vital.
I feel like we're never going to get them out. Yeah, it is vital.
Vital. It's just got to make you fight for it more. And I hate that. I can feel now that I am wealthy, that a Conservative government makes me richer. And my husband said that to me once. He was like, oh, God, like we were going to renegotiate our mortgage or something. And he was just like, oh, God, I can feel myself benefiting from their policies.
Yeah.
I know.
And he was just like, that is just horrendous. Now, in my husband's family, you say you were the first. That's never happened.
Yes.
Nobody in my husband's family has ever gone to university. And so my children have decided in loyalty to them that they won't go either.
I love Brilliant. That.
I'm like, that's not the point. Sticking with Team Dad.
We're going to have to let you go, Jess. I mean, honestly, we could have so many things I could keep talking about.
God,
the list is endless, obviously. We could go on and on. We just always wrap up the show asking our guests if there's a working class hero, unsung hero, they would like to celebrate this week. Who'd that be for you?
Yeah, often I would say my mum, but on this instance, I'm going to say my mother-in-law, who died, sadly, about 3 months ago of a heart attack. And I can't help but, she was 66. I can't help but think her mom died of a stroke at 66. And I just cannot help but think, had she not grown up in the environment that she grew up in, maybe she'd still be alive. And that there is a class element to women who, like my mother-in-law, who die of heart disease and other such illnesses. But she, she's going to be my working class hero. She was everything that people think working class people aren't. She was born in a caravan in Coventry. She grew up in a housing estate in my constituency and she left school at 15. She worked two jobs around going to school. She worked selling potatoes door to door from the local pub after school. And before school, she ran the breakfast at the Wesley Hotel, which is still there. The Macadam pub has sadly been knocked down. And she was the only woman. She had three brothers and she ran away to London at like 16 because she was basically expected to be the slave of her family. She grew up doing midnight flits from the Catalogue Man. But as an adult, like, she was into everything. She worked at the Arts Council. She was an administrator at the Arts Council for 20 years towards the end of her life. But she was an artisan. She cared about crafts and the arts, and she was in the Birmingham Opera. She was in the chorus of the Birmingham Opera. She would put herself forward for anything. She spent ages learning to make Victorian cyanotype photography. She got herself a degree in photography.
Oh, wow.
She was bright and clever and learned, and she could talk about most esoteric arts and crafts movement, or she could lecture the poshest man on earth about public art. And she had no education, no qualifications, was expected to work in a typing pool for the rest of her life. And I miss her dreadfully, but I am surrounded by the art that she made for me and my kids. And she was not, I remember once she said, "People say I'm not working class anymore because I eat couscous." She was like that, still working class. Just like couscous. Just didn't exist in the 1950s.
Oh, what an amazing woman.
Well, I said it did amongst working class communities in Morocco. So she would be my working class hero. She was everything that the government and successive establishments don't know that working class people are.
She's that despite all of... But what wonderful. And what was her name, Jess?
Diana Phillips.
Well, we're celebrating Diana Phillips and you, Jess Phillips, today. Thank you so much for coming on the Proper Class podcast.
Just before we go, I just wanted to say, like, we really meant that at the beginning. Like, a big listening to you speak was a big reason we started this podcast. And I'm sure you know this already, but, like, having you up there, not just speaking for us, but speaking like us, means so, so much.
Oh, and you're very welcome.
Keeps us keeping on. So,
and please keep going. And I really hope you get your childhood ambition and become our Prime Minister, because fuck knows we need it. We need someone
I'm going to take a few years, though, because, like...
It's all right.
You don't want this mess.
No.
I'm going to let them clean up their own bloody mess.
Yeah, and then
I'll
do
swoop
it.
In for the glory years.
We'll be there raising a glass when you do.
Jess, thank you so much. It's been a massive honour. Thank you so much.
No worries. Thanks so much.
Hannah? I know that was a very big moment for the both of us, but I think especially for you. I know we both discovered Jess similarly time, but I know that you're just a huge admirer, aren't you, of what she's doing?
Yeah, a huge admirer of the work she's doing, obviously, particularly with women and girls and all the domestic abuse, like how much noise she's making about that issue. But also, you know, I've had a very political upbringing in a similar way, but just to see somebody up there who I feel like really gets us, represents us, sounds like us, you know, and can sit there and talk in a way and just make us still feel absolutely like politics is for us, about us. I'm a huge, huge fan.
And the truth is, if more politicians were like her, or were allowed to be, I think more people would get out there and vote, actually. More people like, you know, my family members that don't vote and stuff, I think they would. They'd feel like, oh, yeah, we have a voice, because we have a voice through that woman right there.
Who gets us, who knows us, who lives amongst us.
An absolute hero, and I'm actually still shaking. So I really hope you enjoyed that episode, folks, as much as we did.
So that's it for this week. What a week.
I know.
But worry not, listener, we have another amazing guest for you next week. So enjoy yourself. And, Lord, do you want to say it? I suppose you do.
Of course. Keep it classy, guys. Keep it classy. The Proper Class podcast is produced by Michelle Farr-Scott for Rangabee Productions, edited by James Torrance, with music by Tommy Music. Just to let you know, folks, the Proper Class podcast is now going weekly. And whilst I've got you here, please don't forget to like and subscribe. Spread the word. Tell your friends, neighbours, whoever will listen. We've also got an Instagram page. Ooh, get us. And you can follow all the news and goss at the Proper Class podcast. And if you haven't nodded off yet, we've also gone and got ourselves an official email. So do get in touch. The email is properclasspodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening, folks. And remember, keep it classy.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to Quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns. Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to Quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.